Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few moments, the Reverend Wright speaks several times over the weekend and today. How will this impact the presidential campaign? But first, in a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court has ruled that Indiana's strict voter photo ID requirement is constitutional. The law requires voters to present a government-issued voter ID with a picture before they can vote. Indiana Republicans had argued for the requirement on the grounds that it helps combat voter fraud. Democrats and civil rights groups had argued against, saying the law would prevent poor, minority, and elderly voters from casting their ballots. Well, more than 20 states mandate some form of identification at the voting booth. This ruling is said to open the way for other states to follow suit. With us, Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Jonathan, are I'm assuming not surprised at the outcome?
I'm not surprised. First of all, the court has ruled, this is the second ruling on the political process where it's deferred to the states. The earlier one was to support a change in the primary system. And the judges have left this largely under the authority of the states. What's different here is that the court, the majority is saying that a state can impose these types of voter ID requirements, even in states where there's not a history of voter fraud. So one of the arguments was that not only does this impose a very heavy burden on some people, but more importantly, it's a heavy burden that's being imposed when it wasn't clear that there's a serious problem in states like Indiana.
Well, is it clear that there is a heavy burden? Because we're reading that there's not evidence on either side of either fraud or voters unable to get an ID.
Well, it's not a heavy burden in the sense of having, in terms of the state. That is, what's clear about the ruling is that the state does not have to shoulder a burden itself in justifying these laws. The burden I was referring to is on the voters themselves. Under the Indiana law, for example, you are allowed to swear out an affidavit that it was simply too burdensome as a voter to go and get a photo ID, but you can't do that on the spot. You've got to go to a different office. Mm-hmm. And what critics have said is that it guarantees that there's the elderly and the poor are more likely to be challenged and maybe less likely to vote.
Well, I was asking if there's evidence of that burden. You know, have people had to go and fill out the forms? You know, do we see evidence of that in Indiana, or is this upcoming primary going to be a test?
Well, I'm not too sure if they're going to be able to ramp up this system in time for the primary, which is only a week away. And most of these voting laws are so new that we don't have much data. In fact, the briefs that were submitted...
Well, I should say we understand the law is on the books and it's in effect, so...
They may be able to implement it because the question has been, with this pending review, whether they would, in fact, tweak it or require it. But if they do, we'll see. But the problem with the briefs is that they were largely speculative on both sides. Mm-hmm. And what the court is saying here is that regardless of the burden on the voters, it's not such a great burden in comparison to the right or interest of the state. And you've got six justices saying, even if the state doesn't have a history of voting fraud, it has every reason to make sure that it doesn't develop that type of history. And you've got three justices, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, who seem to want to go further and to say that this thing isn't even close, that the states clearly have this authority and can set their own rules to make sure that the right voters are voting.
There were two opinions in the majority and three, as we said, dissenters in the minority. Jonathan, what's your sense of what happens now? Will this photo voter idea spread across the country?
Well, the problem is that it may only spread partially. That is, you may have the red states, Republican states, impose these requirements. This is certainly a green light for those states to impose at least as stringent requirements as Indiana. And you're very likely to see the blue states, the Democratic states, not doing so because they believe this disenfranchises their base. If that happens, you could see calls in Congress for a national law to say, well, look, all those Democratic states are inviting voter fraud, and you could see a fight in Congress. What you may very well see is when the election comes around for the president, not just the primaries, We may indeed be asking for another Bush v. Gore, because these are some of the same states that are marginal states. And so if it comes down to the election and there's a lot of people who have been challenged and a lot of people say they weren't allowed to vote, we could see once again a presidential election held in the balance. If a state like Indiana has a serious voting question, it could very well turn the outcome on the presidential election yet again.
Oh, joy. Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Jonathan, thanks as always.
My great pleasure.
The Reverend Jeremiah Wright spoke out again today, his third major address in 4 days, responding to the firestorm that erupted over old sermons and ties to Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama. Wright spoke to the National Press Club this morning, saying the criticism surrounding him amounts to an attack on the black church, but also represents an opportunity for an honest dialogue on race.
Maybe now we can begin to take steps to move the black religious tradition from the status of invisible to the status of invaluable. Not just for some black people in this country, but for all the people in this country.
Wright spoke before the Washington Press Corps and a very supportive audience of black church leaders. Liz Halloran covered the speech for U.S. News and World Report. She joins us. Liz, what a morning. What are your impressions? What jumped out at you?
Robin, it was quite an amazing hour or so this morning at the National Press Club. The scene first, it was a sold-out event. The ballroom was packed with many black church leaders. It's a kickoff event for a 2-day black church conference here in Washington. The speech itself was fairly restrained but pointed, but when it got to the Q&A, there was a question and answer session after the speech. He was quite combative, quite confident. He rejected questions he thought were not fair. He is not going away. We don't know if Senator Obama would prefer that Reverend Wright stay off the national stage at this crucial point, but it is clear that it's not going to happen.
Well, we want to talk more about that impact, but let's listen to a little of what you referred to. In one of those questions, he was asked about one of those sermon sound bites we've heard, his 9/11 sermon, the phrase chickens coming home to roost sound bite. He was asked about that, and he said again, people haven't heard the full sermon.
If you heard the whole sermon, first of all, you heard that I was quoting the ambassador from Iraq. That's number one. But number two, to quote the Bible, be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever you sow, that you also shall reap. Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You cannot do terrorism on other people and expect it never to come back on you. Those are biblical principles, not Jeremiah Wright bombastic, divisive principles.
Liz Halloran, you cannot do terror on other people and not expect it to come back on you. In explaining what he meant, and that in fact he was quoting, as he said, someone else, and the chickens come to home to roost phrase, that's the soundbite that's going to be played again today, not the entire answer.
Exactly, and that's one of his complaints, and one of the messages that he's been hitting the last few days is that he thinks that what he has said has been taken out of context, that he, and in his speech, he talked a bit about American history with the extermination of the Indians and American military intervention in other places, which he calls imperialism, and he believes that that's a legitimate thing to talk about and why he said that that's where his comments emanated from post 9/11. Now, again, he thinks he's being victimized by sound bites and the corporate media, which is something that he repeated a number of times through his speech to a very receptive audience on that point.
Well, and as he did last night in Detroit at the NAACP and in that conversation with Bill Moyers on Friday, he addressed those who called him unpatriotic for his sermons. He reminded the audience he was a Marine, served for 6 years. He gave up his student deferment, in fact, left college to join the Marines in 61, and then, as we found out, many of us found out for the first time in this programming over the weekend, he eventually trained to be a cardiopulmonary technician at the Naval Medical Center and was part of the team that took care of President Lyndon Johnson during his 1966 surgery. So he pointed out again today he was a Marine and made this comment about his church making sacrifices as well.
My goddaughter's unit just arrived in Iraq this week, while those who call me unpatriotic have used their positions of privilege to avoid military service while sending over 4,000 American boys and girls of every race to die over a lie.
Liz Halloran, your thoughts on that comment?
Well, Robin, that was, as you heard from the audience, a very powerful statement for this audience. And he went on to say that, you know, about his patriotism being questioned, he said, "I served 6 years in the military. Does that make me patriotic? How many years did Dick Cheney serve?" A lot of people stood and whooped and hollered and applauded that line when talking about patriotism.
Let's go to another question. He was asked about his relationship with Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. Here's part of his response.
"So what I think about him, as I said on Bill Moyes and it got edited out, how many other African Americans or European Americans do you know that can get 1 million people together on the mall? He is one of the most important voices in the 20th and 21st century. That's what I think about him. I said, as I said on Bill Moyers, when Louis Farrakhan speaks, it's like E.F. Hutton speaks. All black America listens. Whether they agree with him or not, they listen."
One of the more powerful statements he made about Louis Farrakhan during this morning's talk and during the Q&A is he said, "Louis Farrakhan is not my enemy. He did not put me in chains. He didn't enslave me. He didn't make me this color." And he defended Farrakhan's statements about Zionism 20 years ago. He said his statements about Zionism being a gutter religion are different than if he had said Judaism was a gutter religion. He was making that distinction this morning.
So the distinction being that Zionism is about what Israel as the homeland at all costs?
Yes, exactly.
But he also went out of his way over the weekend, and I think I heard a little bit of it today as well, to reach out to his Jewish supporters.
He said Israel has a right to exist, and he, as he did during his speech, he quoted a lot of scripture. This is a very important point, particularly for the Obama campaign, which the Jewish community, part of the Jewish community, I'm going to say the Jewish community is very divided over Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, but Reverend Wright remains a big problem in parts of the Jewish community, particularly for his relationship with Farrakhan and some of the other perceived as anti-American statements that he made in some of those more incendiary sermons.
Well, you mentioned Barack Obama. So did we get any sense today about, you know, whether the Barack Obama campaign had anything to do with these appearances, objected to the appearances, talked to Reverend Wright at all? What's your sense?
Robin, it's interesting you ask that because I called the contacted the campaign before the speech this morning and then right after the speech and asked exactly those questions. And usually they're fairly responsive, and I did not hear back from them yet. So we don't know. As I said earlier, Senator Obama would prefer that Reverend Wright stay off the national stage. It's a very crucial point. As you know, the senator is battling for wins May 6th in Indiana and North Carolina. Senator McCain has been taking shots at him for his association with Wright. The North Carolina ads that the North Carolina Republican Party is running uses footage of Wright. And Hillary Clinton is working very hard to attempt to paint Senator Obama as out of touch with regular folks. So,
on the other hand, Liz, you know, we're hearing anecdotally from people who say they became enamored with Reverend Wright over the weekend when they got to hear him in his full, you know, in his fullness, not just sound bites. Are you getting a sense that that's also happening this weekend?
It absolutely is, and I've heard the same thing from many people, surprised at what they've learned about Reverend Wright over the weekend. Reverend Wright talked quite extensively today also about the deep, wide, and quite significant work that his church has done while he's been leader of it. As a matter of fact, he joked at one point that he's willing to be considered as a vice presidential candidate. So he is doing himself some good, whether the Obama campaign agrees or not is uncertain.
Liz Halloran of U.S. News and World Report. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, we're well aware that we've been playing sound bites. We'll link you to Reverend Wright's speeches at our website, here-now.org. Back in a minute with columnist Clarence Page, Here and Now. We're back with more consideration of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. He made three appearances over the weekend, culminating with a raucous breakfast speech at the National Press Club this morning. Chicago Tribune syndicated columnist Clarence Page was there. Clarence, your opinion, are these appearances repairing some of the damage to the Barack Obama campaign or maybe causing more?
From what I hear, the Obama campaign did not want him to come out and raise his profile, especially now before the Indiana and North Carolina primaries. But he's his own man, as everyone should know by now, and independent voice. And he does separate his role as a pastor in the prophetic tradition from that of Barack Obama, a politician running for office. And so I think it is better for him to get his side out to the public and let the public see a Reverend Wright that is not just those little quick snippets of sound bites that we've been seeing over and over again on TV.
We have a colleague who came in today and said her 80-something dad, a white Catholic from a working-class town here in Massachusetts, announced that he had just was so taken with Reverend Wright over the weekend.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing about Reverend Wright. There's a culture gap here, not just a black-white gap, but a gap between regular churchgoers and those who aren't, and those who come out of a similar tradition to Reverend Wright, whether white, black, or whatever, and those who come from more quiet, go-along status quo churches, shall we say. And I think, you know, I've heard the same thing from people. And at the same time, I also talked to a white minister today who said it's too bad Reverend Wright looked so arrogant, if only he looked more humble. Well, you're not going to hear that from Reverend Wright. I know him well enough to know that, but he is a man who is an intellectual and a very driven theologian. I think a lot of people respect that, whether they believe, whether they agree with him or not on everything.
He has several master's degrees, several honorary degrees. He has 70 ministries in his church. And yet we hear that one Detroit paper was writing before last night's NAACP appearance that there might be, you know, that he was dangerous, that there might be trouble in the streets. It seemed as if the opposite thing happened. He went to great lengths to say that he's not divisive, but he is about differences. Here he is speaking out about the differences between blacks and whites when it comes to music and keeping time.
For Africans and African Americans, it is not 1 and 3, it is 2 and 4. I don't even have to teach you. Y'all just listen to black people clap to this song. Glory, glory, hallelujah. You are clapping on beats 2 and 4. If you got some white friends, they'll be clapping like this, y'all. You say they can't clap. Yes, they can. They clap in a different way.
Clarence Page, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, he spoke today and over the weekend about one can recognize differences without being divisive. And he's the embodiment of that. Not being from the political world like Barack Obama, he's not there to erase differences. He's there to highlight them and try to reconcile them and bring people to redemption. When you've got political people covering someone who came to give primarily a theological speech, you're going to have people who are combing through his remarks to try to find the inflammatory soundbite, and one can do that, and certainly Barack Obama's political opponents will do that. Listen to him in context, though, and he's talking about bringing differences together.
But as you know, it's the soundbites that most Americans will hear. He refused to distance himself any further from Louis Farrakhan, except to say that he doesn't agree with him on everything. He refused to outright say it would be impossible that the government might not be involved in HIV/AIDS. He said that his comments that he made about HIV and AIDS were someone else's comments. So, Clarence Page, as you said, did he answer the questions that Americans who might not have been charmed by seeing him over the weekend still have?
I think the biggest question I've heard Americans raise of all stripes is how could Barack Obama have spent 20 years in the church with his family listening to that man? And indeed, if you were just judging by the brief sound bites that we've seen repeated over and over again in the mainstream media, that's a legitimate question. I think he gave people a good idea of why Barack Obama and some, 7 or 8,000 other people who are enrolled in his church now, why they have come to him, because he's interesting. He's provocative.
A couple other things that he said over the weekend. He said it's Barack Hussein Obama, but Arabic is a language, not a religion. He asked why people from Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy, for instance, Senator Kennedy, can say pack the ca, and no one says they talk funny, but people accuse African-American kids of speaking funny. A lot of thought-provoking things came out over the weekend.
Yeah, and again, here he's talking about differences and how we perceive difference. And what he's saying speaks directly to a lot of people who haven't been to many black churches, or certainly no evangelical-type black churches, or those that are have the kind of hellfire and brimstone preacher that he is.
We come back to the same question. As illuminating and entertaining and interesting as it might have been for many Americans, how are the Republicans, what are the Republicans going to pull out of these last few days, do you think, to use against Barack Obama?
Well, we know already that there are a number of Republicans, whether John McCain likes it or not, who are already putting together attack ads in North Carolina that sort of try to merge Barack Obama and Reverend Wright in the public mind, because they view Reverend Wright as a really scary, frightening figure to white voters. Reverend Wright, I believe, by going out and speaking, you know, addressing the press, answering questions, doing interviews, is showing people the other Reverend Wright, who isn't so scary. He's controversial, but he's not a nutcase, as he has been portrayed by some observers. In the long run, that's good. How it affects the immediate primaries coming up, we'll have to see.
Chicago Tribune syndicated columnist Clarence Page, who was at the National Press Club breakfast today. And by the way, full disclosure, you've been to Reverend Wright's church.
Oh, yes, and I have friends who were married in that church, and celebrities like Common, the rapper, is a regular member since he was a child, and a lot of other prominent Chicagoans go there, politicians, Mayor Daley, various others go there. It's a leading church in Chicago.
Clarence, thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, why are African-American children developing type 2 diabetes at 5 times the rate of other kids? They account for almost 90% of new cases. Also, Swedish mezzo-soprano Anne-Sophie von Otter. That's all tomorrow. Still ahead today, previously unpublished letters from the late Kurt Vonnegut, Here and Now. Would you ever link the Panama Canal with, say, Karl Rove? You might, after hearing our next guest. A bit of history first. The Panama Canal was built by Americans in the early 1900s on land arguably stolen from Colombia, or as the late Senator S.I. Hawakaya said in the 1970s, "We stole it fair and square." The canal was run by the U.S. until 2000, and then by treaty, the U.S. turned it over to Panama. But 30 years ago, when the U.S. Senate ratified that treaty, it was anything but peaceful. Coming soon after Vietnam, giving up the canal became a raging, hot-button issue about American identity and power. And it may have helped launch the modern conservative movement. Former New York Times Washington correspondent Adam Clymer writes in his new book that the 1978 Panama Canal Treaty is an overlooked moment in American history. His book is called Drawing the Line at the Big Ditch, The Panama Canal Treaties and the Rise of the Right. And he joins us here in the studios. Adam Clymer, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Why did you decide to write this book? Because in talking about it in the office, there are a lot of young people saying, what? The what? Canal? I mean, what compelled you?
Well, in part because, as you quoted it, it's an overlooked moment and reporters like to find things that other people haven't found. But also, I covered the debate in the Senate. I went to the handover ceremonies in 1999. And because, as a kid, I'd been fascinated by the history of the canal, and it was a truly tremendous achievement. Europe hadn't been able to build one. France had tried. Jungle and disease and all of that, and it was a glorious piece of American history.
Let's remind ourselves, the U.S. may have stolen it, but it was with the help of Colombian rebels in 1903. And the U.S. was, you know, as you say, really kind of credited with building it and running it quite well.
Absolutely. I mean, it was an engineering marvel of the time, probably never outdone. And that's part of the reason why this provoked such anxiety in the 70s, the idea of giving it up to a little country like Panama.
But remind us, in the 70s, Jimmy Carter's president, the canal at that point wasn't as important, at least logistically, to the U.S.
No, because bigger ships couldn't get through it. Battleships, aircraft carriers. Panama's actually widening the canal at the moment or working on that.
So why was the debate so hot?
Well, there was the idea of why should we give up this piece of American history. The second element, I think, was We had been beaten by a small country in Vietnam, and people were worrying about where America was going. And probably the strongest argument that Ronald Reagan used against giving it up was that other countries would see if we could be pushed around by Panama while we could be pushed around by almost anyone.
Well,
and in fact, it was a big deal even before Carter pushed the treaties, because in 1976, when Reagan was running for the Republican nomination against Gerry Ford, he made this issue the comeback. He lost five primaries. Then he seized on it in North Carolina, won an upset there. He would probably have had to drop out if it hadn't been for this issue, because he was broke. Nancy Reagan wanted him to quit. And so it enabled him to come very close to Ford and reestablish himself as the logical nominee for 1980. It's not too much to argue that without the Panama Canal issue, Ronald Reagan might not have been president. And if you want to talk about the conservative movement, that's a big subtraction.
That sort of launched the current chapter. And what's interesting is that while he's carrying this banner, this sort of remember the Alamo but applied to the Panama Canal, rallying all the support from Americans, there are strange bedfellows on the other side saying, no, we have to give it up. John Wayne among them.
John Wayne, who was a friend of Reagan's, got absolutely furious with him because he couldn't be persuaded. The argument for giving it up was a complicated one. It was, if we give it to Panama, Panama will have a stake in seeing that it runs well, and the threats of sabotage and insurrection will go away, whereas if we try to hold on to it, we may get into another jungle war like Vietnam. That's a much more complicated, unemotional argument than the Reagan slogan, which was, we bought it, we built it, it's ours, and we're going to keep it.
Right. Well, in March of 1978, the Senate passed the first of two treaties that would give Panama 23 years to train to start to turn the canal over to them. In 78, one Democrat voting for it told his wife, come on and watch me lose my seat. I mean, it was that big.
Absolutely. That was Tom McIntyre of New Hampshire. And there were other senators who expected it might cost them. Howard Baker, so one of the interesting figures, he was the Republican minority leader from Tennessee. He was a plausible presidential candidate for 1980. And his aides, the people he trusted, said, if you vote for this treaty, you'll never be nominated. And he replied, so be it, and not only voted for the treaty, but made sure there were enough Republican votes. But one of those senators that we mentioned, Tom McIntyre, he was one of five Democrats who voted for the treaty who were beaten by Republicans because of this issue. And the consequence of all of that was, when Reagan became president in 1981, he had a Republican Senate to work with to balance a Democratic House. And that made a great deal of difference to the success he had in his first few years as president, particularly the tax-cutting program that was a signature of his administration.
In addition to the Republicans gaining control in Congress, you write that the fight over the Panama Canal led to the birth of political tools that we take for granted nowadays, but flyers and political action committees with independent-sounding names but ties to different sides of the issue. These were born in that time.
Well, the first independent spending, in 2004, we noticed millions being spent by MoveOn.org or Swift Vote Veterans for Truth. But the first independent spending was actually a puny little $16,000 that the American Conservative Union spent on Reagan's behalf in 76, saying, vote for Reagan, he'll keep the canal. And the conservative movement, they developed ads that attacked candidates even before there was anyone running against them. That helped defeat Frank Church in Idaho. They sent out 10 million pieces of mail, and these were remarkably effective mailings because it seemed to people that they could do something about an issue. It was a simple declarative issue. Tell your senator to vote against the treaties or you'll vote against him. And a lot of people did. And some of the foreign policy arguments were a lot more complicated. You know, who could figure out whose weapons were bigger, ours or the Soviet Union's? But this one was simple. This was declarative. It was emotional. Vote against the treaties or I'll vote against you.
Right. So you trace, the current conservative movement 30 years back to this moment in history, this fight over the Panama Canal?
Yes, I do. Not in the sense that this was a singular piece of philosophy for them, but this was the occasion. Keeping Ronald Reagan alive in 76 so he could fight again in 1980 is a pretty significant part of the success of the conservative movement. Mm. And if he hadn't become president, well, who knows where the conservative movement would be.
How funny, because how many people think about the Panama Canal today?
Not very many. It's certainly not the symbol in school books that it was a long time ago.
Right. Adam Clymer, former Washington correspondent for the New York Times. His new book is Drawing the Line at the Big Ditch, the Panama Canal Treaties and the Rise of the Right. Adam, thanks so much for coming by.
It was fun.
And don't forget, in about 6 minutes before we go today, a new reading of Kurt Vonnegut thanks to newly published writings. You're listening to Here and Now. Do you get spam emails from complete strangers selling you sexual devices? Or maybe you've given out too much information and now you're feeling a little naked in cyberspace. Well, Kelsey Felthausen knows the feeling. She's a Master of Fine Arts candidate at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. And for her thesis project, she built a home in the middle of the main quad and lived there for 13 days, completely exposed to the elements and anyone walking by. You can look at pictures by going to our website, here-now.org, while we welcome Kelsey from Fayetteville. And Kelsey, describe this. It's sort of a house in reverse with everything on the outside of a center structure.
That's about it. It is a house on reverse. It has a central rectangle, and then on the outside, it uses those four rectangular walls as an internal wall. So it has a living room, a bedroom, a bathroom, and a kitchen.
You've got paintings or at least some kind of artwork on the wall in the living room. Sort of looks like a cabinet in the exposed bathroom.
Yes, absolutely. I have a bathroom vanity with a mirror in the bathroom, and then also I have my cabinets in the kitchen.
So what possessed you to live this inside-out life?
I felt like it really represented our culture. We're sort of giving up so much, using the web as a perfect example. We give up so much of our private lives and expose ourselves, and I thought this was a perfect way to exemplify that.
We should say it's an art exhibit, and it's called MySpace, so a lot of double entendres there.
Yes, this space actually became much like a living MySpace page. When I wasn't there, or like when you're not online, people went through my favorite books, my favorite movies, pictures of myself and my friends and family, and just sort of became a voyeur into my life. And then often, like they do on a MySpace page, they would ask permission or forgiveness. They would ask to be my friend after the fact, to come by and have a conversation and, you know, ask me to sort of let them go through my things.
Because for people who haven't seen MySpace, I mean, you can literally go in and look at what people's loves and dislikes and, you know, all that, you know, you can do that online. But you're saying that they actually did this when you went to class, when you weren't there, all your stuff was still there?
Yes, believe it or not, all of my things were still there, but definitely some things were gone through. I have video footage from the event and just watching people, you know, play a game of Scrabble or watch a movie or go through even my drawers.
Why would you want to open your life like that? I mean, I'm looking at it. Your bed's right out in the open. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of sounds a little dangerous.
Maybe, but this is a pretty safe community. And as the project went on, I actually, more and more people would come by to check on me. You know, they felt a sort of investment in my safety and in the project. As a matter of fact, people would come by at 2, 3 in the morning. That was one of their favorite times to have conversations with me.
I mean, talk about having your space violated. You're trying to sleep and somebody wants to talk.
Oh, absolutely. I would get into bed as normal about 10:30, and the conversations would usually start about 11 and would go until 2, 3 in the morning, and then would start again at 7 in the morning when the next classes began.
It's interesting. You could have done this as a commentary on the homeless, except they are invisible while you are very visible.
Yeah, I think that's interesting in that just that it was a piece that brought the idea of something that we all share, or at least would like to share, the idea of home, something that's private and a space that we can call our own, and how that space has been made public, or that we choose to make it public by going on things like MySpace and Facebook.
Hmm. Well, what is this? What did you learn? You know, what does this tell you about the way people are increasingly, especially young people, living their lives online?
Well, you know, I never wanted to be more private than after this was over. You know, it really was an exposing experience. I definitely went onto my MySpace page and pulled a few things off of it that I didn't want to say about myself. you know, just to kind of keep my life private. And I hope that that was the message that the piece got across, was that maybe you don't want to put everything out there. Maybe you do need to keep a few things back for yourself.
That's Kelly Felthausen, a Master of Fine Arts candidate at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. And her thesis was, you know, a home that she built and lived in, a completely transparent on the quad at school. Kelsey, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Time for a quick note about a story in the works this week at Here and Now. We're going to measure the bad economy on the home front. One school district might lay off two teachers to pay for gas. They have an extra $50,000 bill for school bus fuel. Another community says the cost of asphalt is putting pothole repair on hold. If your community has an issue like this, let us know. Here-now.org. That's ahead this week. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Literary giant Kurt Vonnegut died 1 year ago this month, and a new collection of his unpublished works has now come out. With a preface from Vonnegut's son Mark, Armageddon in Retrospect has a great deal to say about Vonnegut and war and peace in our time, and it's resonating with readers. It's number 5 on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. Vonnegut, of course, was the writer of the hugely influential novel Slaughterhouse-Five, which was also the name of the underground meat factory locker where he and a handful of other American POWs survived the hellish World War II firebombing of Dresden, Germany. In many of these previously unpublished early letters and writings, you get a sense of what was to come from Vonnegut. In one, a letter he sent his father in 1945 after he was freed, the young Vonnegut writes,
"On about February 14th, the Americans came over, followed by the RAF. Their combined labors killed 250,000 people in 24 hours and destroyed all of Dresden, possibly the world's most beautiful city, but not me. After that, we were put to work carrying corpses from air raid shelters, women, children, old men, dead from concussion, fire, or suffocation. Civilians cursed us and threw rocks as we carried bodies to huge funeral pyres in the city."
That's writer, literary critic, Vonnegut fan, and today our reviewer, Steve Allman, reading from a letter that Kurt Vonnegut wrote home weeks after World War II ended. It's published in Armageddon in Retrospect. Steve, welcome as always.
Good to be here.
What we read in this collection is so painful. What you describe the voice that you're hearing, for instance, in this letter to his dad.
Well, the remarkable thing about the letter is that, you know, this is just weeks after he has witnessed the firebombing in Dresden. So on the one hand, he's writing about all these horrifying things that he's seen. He writes that many of his fellow PLWs died from shock in the Nazi delousing showers, how the entire city sort of died before his eyes and having to pull out, exhume these bodies. But it's written in a way that is almost defensively deadpan, if you know what I mean. In other words, it's as if he is, and this is something, of course, that would later, much later in his career, kind of become his trademark. He's cloaking the despair of the circumstances with a certain kind of hilarity, or at least a sort of gallows humor.
Which could also be, you know, mild hysteria. You know, he probably had some sort of post-traumatic shock at this point.
Well, one of the things that's remarkable, if you just step back from this book for a second, is that this is a letter, and of course, today it would be done in a phone call or an email message or something. This is a 22-year-old private. He'd been in combat for a week when he was captured, who has been put in an absolutely absurd, chaotic, senseless situation. And it's not as if America is unfamiliar with this situation now. I think this is why the book is specifically about war and peace and Vonnegut's experiences in war, and is much more explicit about what he went through as a POW. That's remained kind of the big mystery throughout his career, because in Slaughterhouse-Five and many of his other books, he talks about the firebombing of Dresden, but he doesn't talk explicitly about what he went through. And this is just the first time, really, that we get a personal sense of the kind of trauma that he was actually experiencing at that time as a 22-year-old. He was also, and this is something that I think is generally overlooked, he was a German-American, Vonnegut. His family had been from Germany, you know, had come over from Germany.
He
spoke German. He was the leader of his band of POWs by virtue of being a German speaker. So in an odd way, all of this is happening in what his family regards anyway as sort of the fatherland. It must have been, I think this is part of the reason that he was so exceptionally affected by what happened in Dresden.
Well, and also put this in another context, because he had a lot of tragedy in his life, and this was shortly after one of them.
This is the thing about Vonnegut that always amazes me when I think about the fact that he managed to be a writer, and a writer of such unbelievable hope. This is shortly after his mother has actually committed suicide. The thing about Vonnegut is, if he was writing these days with the way that there's such a kind of lust for survivor stories in the memoir world, he would have had some editor or agent, some Sharpie, saying to him, gee, Kurt, you've got great material, you know?
Well, what do we take out of this? And tell us, you know, one of the best pieces, at least, to do that.
Well, I think the strongest pieces, certainly the most fascinating, are this letter home, the last speech he ever gave. Or actually, he died before he was able to give it, so his son Mark Vonnegut, who's also a writer, actually delivered that speech, and a very brief essay called Wailing Shall Be in All Streets, which is, I think, does a couple of things. It establishes that Vonnegut really was a kind of prophetic voice and when it comes to matters of war and peace. I'd like to read just a couple of little sections from it and then just quickly comment on them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from Wailing Shall Be in All Streets, this brief essay. But the Get Tough America policy, the spirit of revenge, the approbation of all destruction and killing, has earned us a name for obscene brutality and cost the world the possibility of Germany's becoming a peaceful and intellectually fruitful nation in anything but the most remote future. Now, of course, he's decrying the firebombing of Dresden, but if you think of that paragraph and actually replace the possibility of Germany's becoming a peaceful and intellectually fruitful nation with the possibility of Iraq's becoming a peaceful and intellectually fruitful nation, he's really writing in a way that echoes forward. The end of the essay, I think, is actually quite beautiful. And it really speaks to the more hopeful, the kind of determined humanism that Vonnegut expressed throughout his career. He's talking about meeting with the Russians right after the war. And, of course, the Russians are overjoyed and delighted to run into these Americans. He writes, "The occupying Russians, when they discovered that we were Americans, embraced us and congratulated us on the complete desolation our planes had wrought in Dresden. We accepted their congratulations with good grace and proper modesty, but I felt then, as I feel now, that I would have given my life to save Dresden for the world's generations to come. That is how everyone should feel about every city on earth." I think when you're a 22-year-old guy who is having to remove burnt, charred, suffocated bodies of children and women and a little boy, you know, walking his dog, still attached by the leash to his dog, you are simply unable to see warfare in that abstract way. I think that's kind of the miracle of his work, is that it's continuing to say, even after his death, insisting that we look at the morality of what we're engaged in when you're talking about large-scale destruction of human life.
What do you think happened, Steve? You've taught writing. What do you think happened between these essays, which, as you said, get a little hectoring and lecturing and didactic, and Slaughterhouse-Five?
I think he two things happened. One, he discovered that he got tired of being the dutiful young writer who's trying to present these sort of laden ironies that are clearly have an anti-war message. He got tired of his own emotional and psychological evasions in terms of dealing with Dresden, and he also discovered that the best voice that he had was the most natural one, the one that, in fact, in a certain altered form, a much more honest form, is the same voice as is in that letter that he sent to his father, several weeks after the war had ended, that he was best, in other words, just to tell the truth. He also started, he used science fiction and his own imagination as a way of making the war more bearable to write about, and I think that was crucial. He sort of plugged his imagination in so that he didn't feel like he was writing about his own experience. It was a kind of disassociation in an odd way.
That's Steve Ammann speaking about the late Kurt Vonnegut and a new collection of previously unpublished works by Vonnegut called Armageddon in Retrospect. Steve, our literary critic and author in your own right, your book of essays, Not That You Asked, and also your journey into Candyland, Candy Freak.
Lest we forget.
Yes. Steve, thanks as always.
Absolutely.